Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Rebecca Thompson. Rebecca is the outreach director for the American Physical Society. Now, that doesn't mean that she goes out and gives people annual physicals, but rather talks about physics and is the outreach coordinator. She's got a fascinating presentation, a way of bringing physics and science to everyday life. Rebecca Thompson, With Respect. Rebecca, how are you doing today?
Wonderful, John. Thank you so much for having me on.
It is a pleasure. Now, I saw you make a presentation at the Illinois Science Fest a couple of months ago and was fascinated by the way you turned science into culture and showed how modern culture fit together with it. And the program that you talked about was how science interacts or what are the scientific aspects of Game of Thrones? I mean, excuse me, hello, how do you figure Game of Thrones and science? But you did it. So, but I'm going to start off with this, Rebecca. Where are you from originally?
Well, I grew up in Severna Park, Maryland. It's a town just north of Annapolis, Maryland. I actually still live near there today. I love the area. From there, I went to Bryn Mawr College undergrad for undergrad. That was a fantastic experience. It's still an all-women's college, so I have an interesting kind of take on going from an all-women's college to a predominantly male field. But I think that going to an all-women's college really shaped my ability to function in a predominantly male field. But from there, I went to the University of Texas at Austin, had some time in Austin, Hook 'em Horns, loved it there, got my PhD in physics.
A little publicity there. Little publicity there for your alma mater, okay.
Can't help it. You know, somehow UT, it's all about the football. Physics department was excellent, but I still love me some college football.
All right. Well, where are you from? So, now, you said you were from Maryland. What? Tell me about your family. Siblings, parents, what's the deal?
My mom and dad actually separated when I was little, and I have a stepdad and stepsister as well. Mm-hmm. My mom was an elementary school principal, and my dad was a nuclear engineer. So I am a triumph of modern genetics in that I now do science education. So a little bit of both. Well, learned quite a bit about the school system from my mom, which was fascinating, and both of them pushed me hard in math and science, but were very supportive of my love of reading and liberal arts, music, anything outside of science as well. And I think that that's a lot of where I get my ability to look at pop culture, modern culture, and look at the physics, is I was really encouraged to look at try all aspects of life, not just very science focused. And I think that that was a wonderful thing. Really, really enjoyed growing up in Maryland. It was a great suburban town and very close to the water. I'm a swimmer by training, so that was nice to live in that area. My mom, for a long time, was a principal of Tyler Heights Elementary, which was before she took over a struggling elementary school in Annapolis, Maryland, and she really turned it around. It was neat to watch what an impact education can have on kids' lives. These were kids that, you know, many of them only ate at school with the free and reduced price lunch program, and didn't have food on the weekends, and these were kids that she really worked to help and really transform the school and made these kids wants to go on, want to do well in middle school and high school. And it showed me the impact education can have on kids. And that's been really transformative in how I view what I do, is it's extremely important. This education can be extremely important and transformative. And in a lot of cases, just a spark, getting kids interested, getting kids excited, makes them want to work hard in school. And when they have the ability to get a good education, they can end up taking that spark and really taking it forward.
Go ahead. I was going to say, what about your, do you have any siblings?
I have a stepsister who is actually a psychologist at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's a child psychologist, works with kids and sleep disorders. She just had a baby, which was wonderful. I haven't gotten to meet him yet. She had a baby a week ago. So I have a niece and nephew, and that's wonderful. And she loves living in Philly. But our parents got married when I was in college, so a little bit older. Didn't grow up with any siblings, but it's been neat to have a sibling even later in life.
All right. So you said that you got into your interest in reading really was high when you started out as a kid. What kind of reading did you do?
Oh, anything I could get my hands on. I feel like I should say, now that I write comic books, I feel like I should say I read a lot of comic books and graphic novels, but that wasn't really the push back then. I read, you know, anything I could, any chapter books, anything I could get my hands on. I particularly remember enjoying the Wizard of Oz series, even though it's a little younger. I really enjoyed the C.S. Lewis Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe series. I remember that. Mm-hmm. And one of the neatest things growing up is my mom, who was also a big reader, she read to me until I was fairly old. And the fact that I could, even if there were books that, you know, I didn't have kind of the skill to read on my own, she would read to me and we'd talk about them. And one of the games she used to play was, we'd be reading a book together and she'd say, what do you think will happen next? What do you think will happen next? And, unfortunately I've gotten very good at predicting plots, which is unfortunate, but that's one of the reasons I love Game of Thrones is I can't predict it. And I love a show that stops me from being able to predict a plot.
I go to movies or I watch, detective shows on television. I love them. Or I read detective stories, and same thing, I can tell you by, you know, halfway through who did it, and then it's just kind of, well, how did you prepare for, did you prepare me for this, you know, did you follow through properly? My brother hates me, my daughter hates me on this, because I will say, all right, fine, we can turn it off now, I know who did it, and that is not a pretty sight. But did you read, since you're a scientist? You are a scientist, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I am a physicist. I am absolutely 100% physicist.
And obviously you read a lot of science fiction, didn't you?
I did. I was really more into fantasy. Lord of the Rings was really a big deal for me. The Hobbit was one of my favorite books. So sci-fi with a fantasy, you know, it's all still in that kind of umbrella. But the fantasy was really, really my thing. The Hobbit was really one of my favorite books as a kid. And it's always made me want to take up backpacking or hiking just to go on a great adventure like Bilbo Baggins.
You know, you also, I noticed, I remember reading in your bio that there is something that you've taken on as a later life challenge. You said you were a swimmer, but you're also now a triathlete, right?
Yes. I love doing triathlons. I've done 5 Ironman distance triathlons. I'm training for my 6th, which will be August 21st. I've done over 50 triathlons of varying distances. But I love it. I love hard work. I always have. And I think that that's something my parents did a good job making me enjoy. It's the work I like. It's the workouts I like. And the races really just kind of the culmination of that. And the race is fun, but it's the workouts and the daily training and the constantly pushing myself that I just absolutely adore. And there's nothing quite like Ironman triathlons. I know a lot of people don't necessarily know the distances, but it's a 2.4-mile swim, followed immediately by a 112-mile bike, and then followed by a full marathon. So it's a full day event.
To finish out the numbers, because I know you're a number person, that full marathon is 26.2 miles, I believe it is.
26.2, and never call it 26. No marathoner will like it if you call it 26, because it's the last 0.2 that really hurts.
Yeah. Well, and that is, we all know, but we're going to repeat it again, that is from the Battle of Marathon, which was it Lycurgus, or I can't remember his name, Lysander ran back to tell the Athenians that the Greeks had won this battle, and it was 26.2 miles. And when he got to Athens, he said, "We have conquered," and he died. Is that accurate?
That's as accurate as any Greek legend. and he actually said Nike, which is Greek for victory. Uh-huh. And as I am often reminded when people say, "Why do you do this?" People will often say, "Why do you do this? You know, the first guy that did that died."
And he never would have made the 2.4 miles swimming and the 100 miles biking before he could.
Right. And one of my favorite triathlon stories is how the Ironman distance got set was basically a bar bet in Hawaii. It was three guys, a swimmer, a cyclist, and a runner, and they were all out having drinks, hanging out, and one, you know, the swimmer said, "You know, I'm more fit than all you guys." And the cyclist is like, "Are you kidding me? I'm more fit." And the runner's like, "You all are idiots. I'm the most fit." And they said, "Fine, we'll all just race each other's sports." And so they took a rough water swim, which was 2.4 miles. And they said, "After that, we're going to do a bike, standard bike ride that was 112 miles that used to be competed over 2 days." And then they said, "Well, of course we have to finish it out with a marathon. And whoever wins will be called the Ironman." And the sport of triathlon was born over a bar bed on a cocktail napkin.
And so many other great things, like the contract between the head of Domino's and Bo Schembechler was done on a cocktail napkin in a restaurant in Detroit somewhere. So, all right, science is got to be made fun, because otherwise our generation, and I speak, I'm much, much older than you, our generation was not very good at it, but there were people who were. And now we want to take the current generation, and we want to stimulate them to be interested in science. And we're going to take a break. And when we come back, tell us about how you go about making science fun for people who didn't know it was fun. This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect, and we're talking to Rebecca Thompson of the American Physical Society. And we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Rebecca Thompson, who is the Outreach Director for the American Physical Society, and this is John Smetanka. Rebecca, when we broke, we were talking about how do you go about making science interesting to people who don't think it is interesting. How do you get the word out?
Well, one of the things I really try to do, I guess kind of the guiding principle of how I do it, is that people aren't going to find things interesting if you can't relate them to their life. So people are really often really interested in medical breakthroughs because those are relevant to their life. People are interested in drug breakthroughs, pharmaceutical breakthroughs, because those are relevant to their life. So chemistry and biology have it easy. People instantly see how, you know, better living through chemistry. People instantly see better living through biology. But physics is a little bit harder because physics, I always have seen it as kind of the hidden science. People don't look around and say, hey, that's physics. When I started taking physics, I was in high school. I didn't even know what it was. I was on the bus one day and someone said, hey, I think you'd probably be good at physics. And so I signed up for the class. I didn't even know what I'd be learning. And I really held on to that idea that not everybody knows what physics is. No one, you know, people could define biology. People can define chemistry. But people don't necessarily know how to say this is physics. And so my job is to make it relevant to their life. Why do people care about physics? Why is it important to them? Why do they look around and see it? And there's a lot of different ways that you can go about doing that. One of my favorites is my comic book series. I love doing it. And with that, what I was trying to do is take something people were going to do anyway. They're excited about stories. They're excited about graphic novels. That's a big new thing. And so I'm going to take that and put physics in it. So I created a laser superhero. Lasers are amazing. They're used, you know, in pretty much everything. People are surrounded by various things that use lasers, the bar scanners at grocery stores, just DVD players, CD players, not that everyone uses computers nowadays, but still, all of that. And people are surrounded by lasers, and so we created a laser superhero and named her Spectra. But my goal was to make physics interesting, and so what I needed to do was start by making a good story. So I didn't say necessarily, this is the physics I want to teach. What I said is, hey, I got this middle school girl. I have this superhero. If I had laser powers, what would I do? What would happen? How would I feel? What would I want to look at? What would I want to try? And how would my friends react to that? And I made a story out of it. And in that story, I put some physics, and I used it as a way to explain some physics in that story, and I used this laser superhero as a way to talk about some of the physics of the laser. And it's been wonderful. I mean, parents have really enjoyed the fact that they'll give these comics to their kids, and their kids will just eat them up and read them, and they're like any other story. They're not something that's called educational. They're not something that turns kids off because it's something they do in school. It's something that they just want to read in their spare time. It's got pictures, it's colorful, it's bright. Girls love it because it has a character that's a lot like them, and that was very deliberate. And then they find themselves just, you know, talking to their parents about lasers, and their parents are shocked, and, you know, they can talk about various physics concepts. And that was really the goal in doing this. And so I love doing that. I love taking something that people are going to do anyway and putting physics in it. And then for kind of the older set, for the people that, you know, have already chosen their careers and aren't going to go into physics, but really I feel like still need an appreciation for it and to look around and see it. What I like to do is take things that they're already doing. They're already watching Game of Thrones. They're already watching the movie Frozen. They're already watching, you know, Hunger Games. And look at these things and say, hey, let me point out where that physics is. Let me say, stop for a second and look here. And that's not an accident. That's some physics there. And hey, by the way, you can look at it like this, that ice wall in Game of Thrones. Like, let's really look at what's going on there. And point out the physics that they're surrounded by anyway. And what I'm hoping to get out of that is that people can see how relevant that is to their life, that physics isn't just this big thing that's done in labs with, you know, big equipment that costs billions of dollars. This is something that's really all around them. And I think that one of the blessings and curses of physics is that it's that it can be done in giant labs like CERN and, you know, the Large Hadron Collider and the LIGO experiment, but it can also be done in very tiny tabletop. It can be done shaking sand in a box. There's amazing physics in your cornflakes box and, you know, Cracker Jack's box. There's physics tricks to get the prize to come to the top, and all of these small things that you can do anywhere. But everyone hears the word physics and thinks of these big, scary experiments and guys in lab coats with crazy hair. And what I really hope to do is take things that people are already doing and say, hey, look at this. And hey, try this. And that's physics right there. And help them have a better understanding of the scope of physics and that it's not just this one big, you know, thing that they're never going to touch. They're all physicists. I mean, some of the best physicists in the world are little babies that test gravity by dropping things. I mean, mm-hmm. That's what they do. They're some of the...
They flow right after Newton. And now, a couple of scientists from Fermilab, young people, who were talking about catching the wily neutrino. And they just talked and talked, and they were alive. They were fun people. They had they were young people. They did other things besides science, but they're all PhDs, and they're working with very complex concepts and equipment. It's one of those. You mentioned CERN and you mentioned LIGO, but Fermi is one of those huge places which lots of things going on, and they're exciting. If you see it in their eyes, you hear it in their voice, just like you're excited about what you're doing. This is fun if you open yourself up to it, right?
Absolutely. And that I think that it's just something, there's something very human about the joy of discovery. There's something very human about having discovered something yourself, about having made something, about having tried something new, and that just innate curiosity. And scientists have that in spades. They just can't get enough of that feeling of discovering something. They want to know more and more and more. And the absolute curiosity. And what happens if I poke this button? And what happens if I do this? And what if I turn it this way? And what if I put this on its side instead?
Did you ever stop and think about when you're doing this, talking about try it this way, try it this way, try it that way, that it's almost like one of those old horror shows when the heroine or the hero is walking through the deserted house and they come to the door, and you know the audience knows there's a monster down in the basement, and you want to kids especially will say, "Don't go, don't open the door," but you're saying just the opposite: open the door.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying go hang out in abandoned houses and push the buttons. That sounds like a terrible idea, but in controlled ways.
All right, okay. So now your work is with the American Physical Society. What is the American Physical Society?
Well, I often say, as soon as I say I work for the American Physical Society, my personal tagline after that is, we're physicists, not gym teachers. because people are instantly asking me if I can, you know, be their personal trainer. But the American Physical Society is the professional organization for physicists. So we have a membership of about 53,000, and it's all physicists, people that have undergraduate degrees in physics and maybe work in industry now, people that have PhDs and work as researchers. And we're an international organization. We have a huge percentage of our membership that's international. And so we're called the American Physical Society, but we're really a global society. And the mission of the American Physical Society is to get physicists talking to each other. So we want to disseminate the knowledge of physics. And traditionally, that's been by getting physicists to talk to each other in different ways. We put on a number of conferences in various types of physics, different divisions. We have different divisions that look at different types of physics, and they have meetings and talk about what they're doing. We also publish some of the premier journals in physics. So this is a way that we publish people's research. So I don't know how familiar your listeners are with kind of the academic publication process, but what happens is an experiment or research, writes up a paper, and then it goes through the peer review process. And so you have other physicists looking at it and saying, yeah, you're right, or nah, you probably screwed up here, or you forgot a negative sign, or this is great, this is, you know, mind-blowing research. And then once a bunch of physicists have said, hey, this is correct, it's published in one of our journals. So other physicists can build on it, other physicists can replicate it, other physicists can continue the research, or, you know, maybe it refutes earlier findings. And that's one of the big things we do. We also really have a commitment to kind of the greater good. So we have an education department, which is separate from mine, and what they're doing a lot of work in undergraduate education to make sure that our undergraduates, physics undergraduates at every university are getting a very solid physics education. They're also doing a lot to train high school physics teachers to make sure that kids in high school are getting good, solid physics education. And then we have my department that does public outreach. So instead of the teacher training and the more kind of formal education, I bring physics completely outside of the classroom. So I bring physics to the general public. We also have an advocacy group. So we have a Washington office that goes and lobbies for science funding lobbies for, using scientific data in making policy decisions, which is hugely important. One of the big things, I know they just found a new helium reserve, which is huge, and we've done a lot of work trying to make sure that there's enough available helium, which sounds weird, I know. And
stop for a minute. Helium is one of the primary elements, one of the table of elements, and it's a gas in the way that we ordinarily think of it, and it is very basic. My recollection is there's two protons and neutrons in an atom of helium. Is it number two? Am I correct?
Yep. Right. Hydrogen's number one and helium's number two.
Okay. But it has very practical consequences, this helium, because it can be very useful. It's not just on the chart of elements just sits there. It rather is something which everyday use, whose everyday use is very important. And you found a reserve of that?
They just found, and I unfortunately forget which country they found it in. One of the big problems with helium is that it's very, very light. So, with only two protons, it's a very light element. So it's really hard to trap. As soon as you kind of let it out, it just goes up into the atmosphere and goes away. Mm-hmm. So it's extremely hard to kind of trap it, to use it. And we don't necessarily have enough helium. We have a strategic helium reserve, but, we need to make sure there are new sources of helium. And it's been a really big issue. There's been a helium shortage. And so finding this new reserve was a huge deal for physics. One of the biggest, to relate it back to people's everyday lives, why do people care? It's not, I feel like I should insert the obligatory birthday party clown joke here, but it's way more than just balloons. One of the big uses for helium is in MRI machines. So helium, if you turn it into a liquid, is extremely cold, very, very, very cold. And it cools down the magnets to make the MRI machines work. So anybody that needs an MRI, anybody that tears their ACL or has, a slipped disc, they all care about having enough helium, because that makes our medical devices work.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big thing for physics, is finding that. And our Washington office has done a lot to make sure that we have, that our physicists and, medical professionals have access to helium. That was one of the big things that our Washington office worked on.
Now, how about you? When you, I saw a presentation you made about where you tried to make old people like me understand that Game of Thrones was loaded with scientific challenges and factors, and you did a heck of a good job on it. Tell me, take this Game of Thrones, which many of our listeners have watched, and first of all, it's a long-running series about a mythical country that looks a lot of castles and dragons and very fantasy-oriented, but you've teased out science out of that.
Right. You did a great introduction of Game of Thrones. And obviously we had the season finale Sunday night. So I know a lot of people are still kind of trying to process where we are with that.
I hate to do this, but I'm going to take a break right now and we'll come back. We're going to talk about this, the subject I raised, but I do have to put in a break. This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect, and we're talking to Rebecca Thompson, who is with the American Physical Society, a director of outreach services, and has the great ability to turn science through comic books and lectures and other things into something which is interesting to everybody. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Rebecca Thompson, who is talking about her interest in as the outreach director for the American Physical Society in making science of interest to everybody. And one of the areas that she's chosen to have some fun with and also teach science is the Game of Thrones series. And this is John Smetanka. Rebecca, so how can you make Game of Thrones a fantasy that's not real except in the minds and hearts of its listeners? What does science come in?
Well, one of my favorite things, I used to do demo shows for elementary school kids in Austin, and I always loved the fire demos. Those were my favorite. Those were big, explosive. Kids loved it. And so watching Game of Thrones, one of my favorite things is the dragons. I loved watching the dragons, and I know quite a bit about fire. This is something, you know, I've studied, and I know how to do demos, and really have enjoyed that piece of physics. And so I was very curious about Dragonfire, and I started watching the show, and I've read all the books, and initially in this world of Game of Thrones, the world was conquered by Aegon the Conqueror, who came over on this huge dragon that supposedly could breathe black fire. And I'm like, okay, so from a physics point of view, there's no such thing as black fire, but you can tell a lot about the temperature of fire based on its color. And so looking at kind of artist portrayals of this dragon, his fire was white, which if you want something that's anything, the hottest you can get something is this white fire. And so looking at this dragon, looking at this fully grown dragon, it's supposed to be the biggest, you know, this absolutely huge dragon, his fire was also very, very hot. And in the show, you now have these new baby dragons, these tiny little baby dragons. And my curiosity, what I was wondering initially is, well, do dragons just grow in size, or does size relate to heat of fire? And how is fire and size of dragon related? This was obviously a big deal, and it's assumed that the bigger the dragon, the hotter the fire. And what was really neat is knowing a little bit about how different colors mean different temperatures, I could go and look at the baby dragons and see what color their fire is. And obviously, you know, it's a show, and who knows if people are getting it right, or, you know, if the producers decide on dragon fire based on dragon size. But it turns out that the baby dragon fire is very, very orange, and that's a much lower temperature fire. And then as the dragons grow up, and this was the great part, you know, when I first started looking at the physics of Game of Thrones, it was like two seasons in, and now the dragons are all grown, and you can go and look at the color of their new fire, and it's much whiter, it's much hotter. And so this was just such a little thing that my physics mind really latched onto, and hopefully other people found interesting as well, that dragons, that their heat is really proportional to their size and you know, how much they've grown up. And that to me was absolutely fascinating. I love that.
Your theme song for this was, "Come on, dragon, light my fire."
I had not thought of that before, but that would work.
Would you? All right. Lewis is shaking his head at this point. But seriously, this was one that attracted me in your presentation, that you were able to take a simple thing, which a kid who, you know, this is an adult program, but also kids would be, you know, might be watching it, and it stirs their interest. And it leads from one thing to the next. Especially if someone in the family will say, "Well, Billy or Sally, you talked about the heat and all that of dragons. Well, this is great. This is wonderful." And that encouragement from the parents, the people around them, or the teachers, you know, just might be that which triggers their future interest in adult life. And so many times I've been in our shows over the past 10 years, I've talked to people, who was the person that affected you the most in your life? And often it's the parents, obviously, but often it's teachers or somebody that they run across somewhere that they you sit back and you say, well, wait a minute, I remember so-and-so, Father so-and-so, or Mrs. so-and-so, or Mr. so-and-so, that really stoked my interest. I really got into it because I loved him, or I loved her, and you know, they made it fun.
And that's really what I try to do, and I try to get people to look at things differently, and particularly with things like Game of Thrones, or I also have a talk on the physics of the movie Frozen, and to me, what I've always enjoyed in looking at these shows and looking at the physics of these shows is that good physics makes the story better, and good physics, this idea of growing up dragons and fire, you know, getting hotter, that makes the story better. You think you have basically this baby flamethrower, like, why can't Daenerys just, like, you know, take that thing across the water and conquer Westeros with this, like, little, you know, these flying flamethrowers, and it turns out they're just not hot enough, and that makes for a good story. That adds tension, that adds conflict, and the fact that good science can add that to a story instead of take away, I think is awesome. And when I do the comic books, I try and do that. I try and make sure that the good physics is making the story better, not being thrown in there. And one of the things, I've read a lot of educational comics. I'm not the only one to do this. I've read quite a few, and one of the things that has turned me off on a lot of them is it's very much like, oh, we're going to teach you physics now, and we're going to teach you science now, and there's no need for that. This really good physics can make for a better story. And I think that that's one of the things that George R. R. Martin with Game of Thrones did, with maybe not even realizing it. He might not have realized, you know, what he was doing. And the one thing I take issue with him, his physics is very good, in a lot of cases holds up, but the one thing that has always bothered me is the ice wall. And it seems so easy. It's ice. This seems like it has to be this fantastic defense mechanism, but ice is a really, really complicated solid. It's not normal at all. Usually when you have a solid, the molecules are closer together than they are in a liquid, and in ice it's the opposite. And because of that, because in ice the molecules are staying farther apart, if you push them closer together, it becomes a liquid. So you've got this ice wall. At the bottom of the ice wall, it's under enormous pressure. So it would actually turn to liquid and then freeze a little bit and turn to liquid. And you can't physically have an ice wall. It seems like it'd be great. It adds tension to the plot. It adds this whole aspect of, you know, beyond the wall, and you need something like that, but there's just no way it could happen. And it, for everything he did right, almost, I don't know if it was on purpose or not, he managed to get ice wrong. So that's the one that always, you know, my physics brain chafes a little bit at that one.
We here in Michigan, most of the northern parts of the United States have something quite to the contrary. We say we have ice blocks in our gutters during the wintertime, and where the snow melts a little bit and it starts to run down, and then it freezes, and it doesn't all get melted or drained away, and the ice keeps building up and building up. Pretty soon you're living in an igloo which is so heavy that the gutters start to fall off, or the roof starts to fall apart or leak. So you know now we're talking about something again which is a very great practical consequence. How do you deal with an ice wall, or in this case, an ice block? And, you know, I want you to think about that in your next comic, that you've got your laser person figuring out how we, who are stuck with these ice blocks on our roof, can actually can get rid of them. Is that a challenge?
It's actually mathematically very challenging. So I have good friends in Boston, and, you know, as you know, last winter they just got completely dumped on with snow, just absolutely miserable. And it was March, and one of my friends was like, there's still, you know, 3 feet of snow in my front yard. When will I see my grass again? You're a physicist. Tell me when I'll see my grass again. And it's ice melting, snow melting is such a complicated problem because you've got so many things going on. It's not straightforward. You've got the sun melting the ice, but then at the bottom, in the center of this block, you've got, it's very insulated. And so it's very, very hard. The more surface area you have, the easier it's going to be to melt. I mean, that's an easy experiment you can do at home. Like, you can watch how fast different, ice cubes of different sizes will melt based on surface area or different shapes. So the bigger blocks actually have smaller surface area to volume ratios. So it's harder, the bigger the block, the harder it is to melt. So as these things grow and grow and grow, you're making it harder and harder and harder to melt, but not at a normal rate. So it's not like if it's twice as big, it's going to be twice as hard to melt. It's going to be significantly harder to melt because it's keeping itself cool. It's keeping itself frozen. And so I don't know how you all deal with it. I mean, I can't even imagine. There's no way I'd move north of Maryland. So I got to hand it to y'all.
Oh, no. I get that y'all. That's that Texas accent coming in. But that doesn't come from Maryland, I know. But we considered a mark of manhood, womanhood, that we stick it out. We're tough, except for those of us who get older and go to Florida to thaw out during the wintertime. But now, go ahead.
Oh, I can understand doing that.
Well, but science is, I raise the topic of science fiction, and we've been talking now about sort of the fantasy parallel to science fiction. But I want to talk about what is strictly science fiction, and that is, it started with Jules Verne or before, and these writers would talk about these fantastic things that they never happened. And they did. Submarines, planes, the center of the world, atomic power. All of these things got their start in, obviously, in nature, but somebody came up with the idea, the idea of, hey, what if? And they create interest in kids and people. I read science fiction when I was a kid. My mother, bless her soul, would get so ticked off at me because I would tell her about going to the moon because I was reading science fiction. And she said, John, and she was a school teacher, by the way, for 30 years. She was, John, why are you wasting this? You know, read history, read something else. But, I mean, science fiction, John, no one is going to go to the moon. And I heard that over and over again when I was a kid. And I want to call her back and say, wait a minute, come back here. I need to talk to you about this. But now, so that's easy. You know, we're going to go to the moon. We're going to go to Mars. These are all things which 20, 30, 40 years ago were in the totally speculative realm, if not totally, but relatively speculative realm. Now, it's progressed to a whole new level. Because I remember reading Isaac Asimov wrote a series of books on robots, another set of books on what he called the Foundation series, which dealt with the ability to mathematically predict human behavior, very deterministic. And then the one that's really popular now is these alternate universes that.
Yeah.
Where there's an infinite number of us out there doing different things in different universes at the same, quote, time. This is fascinating. This is really interesting stuff.
I would agree, particularly the many worlds. This is a really interesting physics idea. It all kind of comes back to quantum mechanics. And when the ideas of quantum mechanics were first being developed, there's different ways to interpret the math. The math works. The theory works. We can predict things with this theory. But there are different interpretations, and kind of the one that has caught on that most physicists have used since the very beginning is called the Copenhagen interpretation, because it was developed in Copenhagen. And with that idea, you only have one world, and then it's all based on probabilities. But there's also this thing called the many worlds hypothesis, which is this exact idea, is that in reality, there are many, many, many worlds, that every choice, both choices happen, And we are in a world where just one of the choices happen, and that other choice creates another world. And
all
it's called the many world hypothesis.
Hold on for just a second, because we have to get one of those mandatory breaks. And we're going to be coming back, and we're going to finish talking about this, because this is really interesting for me, I guess, maybe, hopefully other people as well. This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect, and we're talking to Rebecca Thompson, who is the Outreach Director for the American Physical Society, Worldwide Society, helping people, scientists, talk to one another, educate one another, but also bringing physics to the real world. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Rebecca Thompson. Rebecca is the Outreach Director for the American Physical Society, a society which brings scientists together, allows them to be hothouses for ideas, exchange of information, but also, as she does, bringing to the outside world the beauty and the importance and the fun of physics. This is John Smetanka. So, Rebecca, when we broke, you were talking about the Copenhagen theory, and essentially, if I summarize this a little bit, it goes something like this. If there are two or three possibilities or 10 possibilities as to a certain kind of event, you know, you can go to the store, you can go to the movies, you can go to the restaurant, you can go to the beach, you can go get on a bicycle. Essentially, is it not correct to say that this theory is that in some place all of those things happen? Am I correct on that?
That would be the many worlds hypothesis. That is correct. So I feel like I can't be a physicist and not make reference to Schrodinger's cat, right?
Oh, I love Schrodinger's cat. That came up in another one of my favorite series, which is Big Bang Theory.
Yes. So Schrodinger's cat, you've got a cat in a box, there's poison, there's a 50% chance the poison will be released, a 50% chance it won't be. And in the Copenhagen interpretation, if you haven't opened the box yet, the cat is both alive and dead at the same time. And then you open the box and it is either alive or dead. You've collapsed this probability into one way or another. And the many worlds interpretation, you open the box and let's say the cat's alive. There's also created a world where the cat is dead. So instead of collapsing this probability into one way or another, you're creating another world. And that other world, the cat, is the opposite of what you're seeing. And there's, you know, a whole other situation. And the many worlds hypothesis really was not, people really went with the Copenhagen interpretation. It made more sense. And the many worlds hypothesis is kind of coming back. There's no reason this isn't a reasonable way to look at it other than it's just weird. There's no mathy reason this shouldn't happen. And so sci-fi authors really latched onto that because multiple universes is really cool. It's a really great plot device. And so, hey, if science says that this can happen, I'm going to write about it. And that's one of the things that has made sci-fi, you know, a plot device in sci-fi that has been fantastic, and there's no physical reason it shouldn't be possible.
Now, I mentioned one of my favorite shows, which is The Big Bang Theory. Do you watch that at all?
I do, actually, and I've been to two tapings. I'm friends with the science advisor, David Salzberg, and I can say very definitively that the science, the physics in that show is fantastic. Their physics is right. So anything that you're seeing them talk about, any of the physics, any of the science they're talking about, that's all correct. David makes sure that that is completely, completely correct.
For those few, Americans in our audience who have never watched The Big Bang Theory, I will say that it is something that I came to sort of late in the I think about the third season. However, this is a worldwide phenomenon. I mean, I teach over in the Czech Republic and the Slovak Republic. What do they watch? The Big Bang Theory. They've picked out their favorite characters. And then they sit there and they talk about the Schroten, whatever it is, cat. And,
yep.
and they go on. They talk about alternate universes. They talked about quantum mechanics. They talk about Einsteinian relativity. And they play with experiments going. They're going to send their signal around the world in a series of computers, and they end up dealing with Chinese characters, Chinese people over in that part of the world. It's great stuff. And then they've got romance and fun built into it.
And it's all true. I mean, it's all very, very true, to the point that when I watch the show, it is so similar to grad school, except they have much nicer apartments. it's so similar to grad school that I don't understand how anybody else finds it funny, because to me, it's just a parody of my life. And I don't understand how people that haven't lived my life find this hilarious, but I'm glad they do.
Oh, it literally is a worldwide phenomenon. If you haven't seen the reruns, it's worthwhile catching up on a few of them. And they're little vignettes. It's like some other shows were introduced that you can almost take each one of them, even though it's a long series of 12 seasons, and each one of them has its own life to it. Well, the same thing applies to Big Bang Theory, in my view.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you don't have to, it's not something like Game of Thrones where you have to watch from the beginning. You can just pick up an episode and watch, and it's funny, and you can figure out what's going on. And one of the things I love, just because I know David Salzberg, we've sent him a lot of posters advertising APS, American Physical Society, advertising our website. And so if you look in the background, you'll see a bunch of APS stuff. That's all very exciting to me. So.
Yeah, a little paid or unpaid advertising. I love that.
Right. It's
product
wonderful.
Placement. Product placement.
Yep. That's exactly it.
So where do you go from here? I mean, you're now writing cartoons, or rather comic books, and I presume you're using television and computers, social media. Are all those things in your purview?
Absolutely. One of the big things that we're starting this summer is a Snapchat campaign. We're one of the first societies to really reach out and try Snapchat, because that's something that a lot of high schoolers and middle schoolers are using, but hasn't quite reached people my age yet. So we have an intern that's doing a fantastic job looking at Snapchat. Another thing we want to move into is virtual reality. So the new Samsung Edge, I think it's the Galaxy 7. When you get a Galaxy 7, you get a free like VR goggle set. I forget what the fancy name of it is, and they're fantastic videos and ways you can really be immersed in an experience. And so you can be immersed in an experience riding with the Blue Angels or underwater with SeaWorld. And we want to figure out ways that we can harness that technology to give people immersive physics experiences, whether it's touring, the Large Hadron Collider, or, going to virtual science museums or virtual experiments, or, cartoons of being inside an atom, something to really throw people into the physics. And I think that this is something that we can hopefully branch into soon, but is a fantastic learning experience, because you can watch the Blue Angels fly, but it's nothing like being in the cockpit.
Well, let me tell you, a client of mine and now friend, when he was a computer geek from the word go, and he came up with an idea which I thought was wonderful. He couldn't get it sold. But it went very much along these lines. He was very struck by the sadness of children in children's hospitals who are stuck. They can't go out. They can't go out because of their susceptibility to germs, or because they're going through chemotherapy, or whatever it happens to be. And he came up with the idea of this virtual reality. He would put he'd write the programs to put goggles on, and take them on tours of the world. So they get a chance to see the pyramids and the Taj Mahal and New York City and London and Paris and the Antarctic and so on and so on. And he was actually working with, George Lucas to make this happen. But this is 15 years ago. Now they're doing it. And unfortunately, he's off doing something else with his life. But I thought that was so neat, such a great use for science that we can really help people who can't help themselves.
And one of the neat things, I believe it's Discovery Channel Education, one of the neat things they're developing is a system where you can have a teacher at the front guiding the students through the VR. So the teacher is involved in the VR experience. And what this means is schools that can't afford field trips, kids that, can't even afford, food on the weekends, they can have these field trip experiences and can have a guided field trip experience and have a learning aspect to it. And that addition of the teacher in the equation is huge. So I'm really excited to see what Discovery Education comes out with in that realm, in that direction, because it opens up a whole new world for students that just aren't going to have an experience like that anywhere else, not just overseas, but even just to, the Maryland Science Museum. They just don't have the ability to do that. And this is a way that can bring it there. And if they can't afford the VR technology, the VR goggles from Samsung, there's the Google Cardboard is kind of a lower tech version that is extremely inexpensive and something the students can use. And I'm fascinated about how this can bring science to everybody, not just the people that have the resources to experience it.
Now, I've got to tell you, I've through this hour and watching you doing the show in Illinois, you look like you're really kind of bored. Is that the way it is? Do I detect a little excitement here?
To tell sarcasm over the phone, but I'm going to guess you're going with that.
Yeah, that's what my daughter would say. Dad, that was sarcasm. Wake up.
Yeah, eye rolls aren't transmitted over the phone.
No, they are. But you sound like you really love what you're doing.
I do. I do. I think it combines so many passions of mine. And I always, when talking to students, people ask how I ended up in the career that I ended up in. And really, I wasn't ever hired to write comic books. I was hired to get the public interested in physics. And people had a way they thought that was done. And yeah. I just figured out how to make the job I have the job I want. And that's my advice, my maternal advice to students is you're never going to find the perfect job description, but what you can do is find a job and convince them that you need to be doing what you want to be doing.
I've had
the opportunity to do that.
Rebecca, congratulations for finding that niche in your life that where you can match your ideals and your dreams with your pleasure. And this is obvious from your tone of voice and how you deal with the whole program. So, unfortunately, we're out of time. Rebecca Thompson, thank you very much for being our guest in our discussion show with respect. And I hope you can come back again later.
I'd love to. Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Sunday. We've been recording here in WSJM in St. Joseph, Benton Harbor, Michigan, but we're on WSJM and also WRHC. Remember, for next time, during our lives, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you. Done.